Well, as April begins, we begin an entirely new Issues Etc. Book of the Month. The very first Easter. Today we're going to talk with the author of that book, Dr. Paul Meyer, about the events leading up to Easter, Jesus' entrance into Jerusalem, the meeting in the upper room with the disciples, the events at the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus' betrayal and arrest. That'll be the first half hour of Issues Etc. today. Dr. Paul Meyer will join us in just a moment. In the second half hour of the program, Dr. Pia DeSeleni joins us. She's a research fellow for the Center of Human Life and Bioethics for the Family Research Council, based in Washington, D.C. We're going to talk to her about two issues. First, the impact of cloning on women, and second, the AIDS relief bill that is in the U.S. House, her concerns about that in the second half hour of Issues Etc. today. In the second hour of the program, Doug Wilson. It's been a while since Doug Wilson has joined us, but he's got a book, The Case for Classical Christian Education. We'll be talking with him about classical Christian education, getting a primer on that in the second hour of the program. And then finally in the third hour, open lines for your questions and your comments. I was reading recently, this must have been the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Let me pull it out here. No, it's USA Today. Under the fold in the way back in the D section, no rest on the Sabbath for the Iraq war debate. Some preach peace, others find justification. A picture there, perhaps you saw this, of Dr. James Kennedy, and he's quoted as saying, "If we are offending God and robbing our nation of the blessings of heaven upon our battles, it is the soldiers who will bear the brunt of our lack of blessings." He's trying to make the case that God blesses our nation, and that if we have done something to anger God so that he will not bless us, that lack of blessings will be manifest, he says, on the battlefield. He's pictured there in front of a line of American flags. I'd like to know during that third hour, open lines for your questions and your comments, what do you think of Dr. Kennedy's assessment of this war situation? That if America is immoral and does not warrant or merit the blessings of God, our soldiers will pay. And we'll talk about several other things in the course of that third hour of open lines for your questions and your comments. You know, we tell our children the story of Easter, and most of us, unless we've done some in-depth study, don't really, well, we know the details of the story, but most of us haven't been there to the places where Jesus entered into Jerusalem, where he went with his disciples to the upper room on the night when he was betrayed and arrested. We know the events of the betrayal, but maybe we're not able to answer some of our children's questions, like, why was Judas paid 30 pieces of silver? Was that a lot of money? Why did Judas kiss our Savior as a sign of betrayal? What did that mean? Do we know where the upper room is? Those kind of questions come up with our children when we're telling them the story of the events leading up to Christ's resurrection. We'll be getting answers to some of those questions with Dr. Paul Meyer here in just a moment on Issues Etc. Now, something I'd like you to think about in advance of that open lines hour with regard to the war, we are hearing an awful lot nowadays. In fact, I think it's split 50-50 now. We are hearing about the war itself, and then we're hearing about those who are bringing us the war. The coverage of the war has begun to affect everyone's way of thinking about it. Ellen Goodman has written a column, maybe you read this one, "The former outsiders are now insiders in war as well in peace." She makes the case there that women are not the nurturers that they are stereotypically described as. And of course, all of us have seen the terrible footage of this young servicewoman, I don't know what else to call her, this young servicewoman who has been taken hostage. We don't know whether she's dead or alive. And the sight of a woman being held as a prisoner of war, I have to admit, is altogether a different sight than a man being held as a prisoner of war. The thought of our prisoners of war as men being tortured or murdered is horrific enough, but the thought of a prisoner of war being a woman tortured or murdered takes on an entirely different quality for me, at least in my mind. I want to know, when Open Lines rolls around, what you think of Ellen Goodman's assessment that women are not the nurturers. They're tough. They can, there they are on the battlefield. That's a place for them. I'm hoping that perhaps this will cause the military and our society to completely rethink the issue of women in the military altogether, and especially the drive toward women in combat. But I'm also curious about what you think as well, especially you women. I was just talking before the show with one of the staff people here at the radio station. She saw a picture of my younger brother that I have posted up in my office. He is currently down in Fort Hood, Killeen, Texas, and he's preparing later in this week to go and join the tip of the spear, as they call it, to punch through in Baghdad as a combat engineer. She says, is that someone related to you? I said, yeah, that's my little brother. He's going over there. She said, well, her sister and brother-in-law, both of them, mom and dad of a two-year-old, are also going. I said, how can that be? You send the husband, I understand that, but you send the mother as well? Husband and wife, leaving the two-year-old at home with relatives? There's got to be a way around that. I thought this notion of women in the military would have provided for the children, at least, to be taken care of, especially when they're not just being sent over there to sweep floors or hand out boxes of humanitarian aid. They're being sent over there into harm's way, in danger. We'll talk a little bit about women in the military in the third hour of Issues, Etc. today. Dr. Paul Meyer is professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo. He's a regular guest here on Issues, Etc., and he's author of several books, including one that's very good, In the Fullness of Time, and our Issues, Etc., book of the month for April. It's for your children and your grandchildren. It's called The Very First Easter. Dr. Meyer, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Good to talk with you again, Todd.
Let's jump right into the events leading up to Jesus' resurrection, and talk about Jesus' entrance into Jerusalem, the story of Jesus riding in on a donkey, the people are throwing the palm branches down, paving his way with their cloaks and their clothes. Set the picture for us. How many people do you suspect were in Jerusalem at the time of Jesus' entrance there?
Well, Todd, regularly Jerusalem would be about 50,000 people. That was pretty big for a city in those days. However, this was the Passover festival, and for that reason, you're going to have maybe three or four times as many people in Jerusalem at that particular time. Some estimates running as high as 200,000, 150,000, 200,000 or so. This is the reason why Pontius Pilate and the Romans would have to kind of be on guard during that particular week, because any time you get a big crowd together, that has the possibilities for insurrection. And that's why ordinarily Pilate, for example, the judge on Good Friday, would be living up at Caesarea, which is a beautiful seaside spot, as you well know. But once a year he would come to Jerusalem.
All right. Why did Jesus ride in on a donkey? What's that all about?
Well, it's interesting. Some have said it's a sign of humility. On the other hand, a donkey was the vehicle that King David 1,000 years earlier had used to ride into Jerusalem. It was kind of a royal conveyance, despite the otherwise menial nature of that animal.
So I once heard that the donkey was the royal steed during times of peace, and the horse was the royal steed in times of war.
That's as good an explanation as any.
So the people are waving these palm branches and laying down their clothes. Is there a significance to this action?
Well, by the way, they're simply branches. We're not quite sure they were palm branches, but why not? the whole idea is nobody's around with ticker tape or helium balloons, and so this is the sort of instrument you would use to express your adulation on a day like this. It was kind of laying down the red carpet of welcome. It was a way of cheering the person on whom you were honoring. And it was, quite a big show, I'm sure. And this is one of the things, of course, that got the priests very suspicious. And probably already at this time they would alert Pontius Pilate that there might be trouble.
So am I picturing this correctly? Here is Jesus riding in. It catches quite a bit of attention of the crowds that are streaming in and out of Jerusalem at the time, a city full and overflowing. This was not some little event happening over on the sidelines. This would have caught the attention of all the city.
Yes, it certainly would have. I think it's a ballsy public gesture on Jesus' part. You know, as sometimes he materialized in Jerusalem without advance notice. In fact, one of the Passovers, you recall, people were debating, is he going to come this year or is he not? This, however, was a case of Jesus not sneaking into town. No longer is he telling his disciples and those whom he cured, don't tell anybody about this. This was his public debut because it was the culmination of his ministry for us in suffering and dying.
Stepping ahead, I'd like to spend a time talking about the week therein, but I don't think we have the time for that this afternoon. Jumping to the night in which Jesus was betrayed, when Jesus met with his disciples on Maundy Thursday for the Passover, we're told they met in an upper room. Do we know where this spot was and what it might have been like, what this location for their meeting was like?
Traditionally, the upper room area has been assigned to the southwestern corner of Jerusalem, the Mount Zion area. Whether or not that's accurate is somewhat dependent upon an early church that was built there. The site that tourists are shown today in Jerusalem as the upper room is very unconvincing for two reasons. First of all, Jerusalem was 15 feet lower in Jesus' day. You can tell that if you go to the Damascus Gate at the northwestern end of Jerusalem. There you see the Damascus Gate built by Hadrian, 15 feet under the bridge that leads from the main street today into the Damascus Gate, whereas the Damascus Gate today is at ground level, 15 feet higher. And unfortunately, the upper room that they show you today is still an upper room, which means something's wrong here. And the very fact that inside they have Gothic arches also shows that this is not authentic, because the Gothic arch will not be invented for about 11 centuries
yet. So what did this upper room look like? What would it have been like if we don't know its exact location?
Well, there's several theses on that. Many scholars think it was the townhouse that belonged to John Mark's mother. Because later on you're going to find the disciples and the early Christians after Pentecost meeting in the upper room. This is where you recall Peter first went after he was delivered from prison, Acts chapter 12. So it must have been a fairly spacious situation in order to accommodate perhaps not only the disciples, but even those who were looking on in the Pentecost area, because they were all gathered together again in an upper room, you recall.
Enough to hold 120 people?
This does not mean they were all inside necessarily. There could have been a veranda overlooking that area, and maybe big enough to hold 120. We're just not sure. Mark's mother seems to have been wealthy in any case.
Okay, skipping ahead then to the Garden of Gethsemane. What was the garden like?
Well, we can get some idea of what it was like today yet, because there are about 12 ancient olive trees that are situated just beyond the Brook Kidron on the east side of Jerusalem. I'm not going to go so far as to say those were the very olive trees that witnessed Jesus' passion, but they could have been offshoots from the very roots of those trees. It's hard to say. The olive tree does live a very, very long time. And this would be a natural place for a grove, because there was a big valley separating Jerusalem from the Mount of Olives. It was called the Brook Kidron Valley. And the Garden of Gethsemane is where an ancient oil press was located on the east bank of that Kidron River Valley. And this traditionally is where the Franciscans have a lovely church for meditation to the present day. It's called the Church of All Nations.
So you've been there and you've taken people there. Is what exists there today in any sense what would have existed there as a garden at the time of Jesus' passion?
Some things yes, some things no. Now, the basic topography is not going to change that much at all. You're going to get the kind of a butte on which Jerusalem is built, which is on the tablelands only in the north. Otherwise, it's surrounded by the Cheesemakers Valley in the west and the Hinnom Valley to the south and the Kidron Valley to the east. So it's kind of a Y-shaped situation in which Jerusalem is built. But the Mount of Olives certainly is still there. It's obviously the same mount that was there 2,000 years ago. And so the great natural phenomena have not changed across 2,000 years. Sea of Galilee is absolutely authentic. The Jordan River is the Dead Sea. Those basic features have not changed.
When Judas arrives, he arrives with a crowd for Jesus' arrest, and he gives Jesus' identity away with a kiss. Why a kiss?
Well, that's an interesting question. The reason basically is this. We assume that ancient eyesight was just as accurate and good as ours is today. Well, that's not true. Here in an era of the best medical care in the world, we still have, you know, over half of the population wearing glasses or contacts or sight correction devices, and ancient eyesight was no better. In fact, it was worse, and they had no sight correction devices, no glasses of any kind. Now, add to that the further problem that this is at night. There's no normal artificial lighting around. If you're going to have torches, you only have a flickering image that changes all the time because of the light shadows. You can't be sure who is Jesus, because all the men look alike in those days. They all have cropped beards. The hair is parted in the middle. They dress similarly. And so it's really a bigger problem than we might think. You don't look in the newspaper or in Time or Newsweek to see what Jesus looks like. I mean, there's not a popular published image of him. And so how are you going to know who Jesus is? And so here you have the problem of locating a group of men in a dark ravine there, and you know, you can't be sure any of them is Jesus, and so you have to have an insider pick him out. And that's why a Judas figure is actually necessary for that, even though some critics have scoffed at the idea.
Judas was paid 30 pieces of silver to betray Jesus. Was this a lot of money?
Oh, generally it's been estimated it would buy you a suit of clothes. So it depends on where you shop today, you know, pennies or Hartshafter and Marks or so. It would be maybe $100, $150 today.
Is the case there in Scripture, do you think there's a point being made that Jesus was betrayed for a paltry sum when it's listed as 30 pieces of silver rather than just some sort of bribe?
Well, it certainly was a bit paltry. It's certainly no reason to turn your own boss in, so to speak, your own benevolent master. And so, of course, scholars have debated for ages as to why Judas did this. Some have thought that he was a zealot. He wanted to force Jesus to play his hand in order to kindle the great revolution against the Romans. Others have tried to say that he did this because he was wanted money, pilfering the treasury. And there are various theories that have been advanced. It's true he was paid for his betrayal, so money did enter in. There's no question about that.
In the Garden of Gethsemane, before his betrayal and arrest, Jesus prays there in a common place of prayer for Jesus. But people often wonder, he's praying to God, but Jesus is God. What's that all about?
Well, he's praying to God according to his human nature. We have to remember again that in Jesus we have the most unusual phenomenon in all of God's creation. We have God and man in one person. Sometimes the human nature of Christ will overrule the divine nature. At other times, the divine nature over the human nature, as, for example, at the Transfiguration. That's when the divine overcame the human in terms of how Jesus shone with the light of God. Here we have the human more in charge than the divine. And therefore, according to that, Jesus could actually die because God himself can't die.
The disciples during Jesus' times of prayer there on that evening can't keep awake. Why is this?
Well, you have to remember the ancient day began at dawn, ended at dusk. You don't have much good artificial lighting over there. So people generally went to bed when the sun went down. So we estimate that Jesus was arrested about 10 p.m. in the garden, and this would be considerably after most people had gone to bed. So this was their regular witching hour. It'd be sort of like our 2 a.m. or something like that. And so if you have a natural sleep cycle and you're just sitting there waiting while Jesus prays, you're gonna get drowsy.
And besides that fact, I imagine they've just celebrated the Passover. with not only a big meal, but what would probably amount to several bottles of wine.
I'd say some vino was left afterwards. You're right. As far as I'm concerned, it's always a somewhat soporific factor.
That's an interesting way of putting it. The group that comes with Judas, who is this group of men that come with Judas to take Jesus under custody?
Big debate over that one, Todd. Most scholars assume, of course, that it was a Jewish temple guard. But the term is used in John's Gospel. I think it's called the Heliarchos. That would be a Roman title, but it could also be used for the captain of the Jewish temple guard. I firmly think that it was a Jewish temple guard. I see no reason why Pontius Pilate, with his limited number of Roman troops in Jerusalem at that time, would release them for a detail like this. He hasn't even had the case put before him. Why should he intervene at a time when Josephus, the first century Jewish historian, tells us there were 10,000 in the temple police alone? So the biggest single constabulary in Jerusalem would be the temple police. And therefore, since he's brought first, he's not brought under Roman control, he's brought to the Sanhedrin. And so I think the evidence is overpowering that it was a Jewish temple guard that was involved here.
And when they take him into custody, we've got about 2 minutes here before the break. When they take him into custody, would that have been the equivalent of being under civil arrest, like we think about it today?
Yes, it would. There was some limited police power allowed the Sanhedrin in Jerusalem. They could not carry out a sentence of execution. They might do it illegally when the Romans aren't around, for example, a kind of a posse action, as happened in the case of Stephen, you recall. See, by that time, Pontius Pilate had gone back to his headquarters in Caesarea, and so he wasn't around. And that's why a lynch mob could come along and accomplish something like this. But this time, the Romans were very fully present in Jerusalem. Therefore, when it came to execution, it would have to be the Roman governor who would take over.
Dr. Paul Meyer will be with us for about 5 minutes after this break, folks. There's something that has always, and especially lately, made me very curious when you look at the story of the Passion. Several years ago, when I was serving as a parish pastor, during the time of Lent, we did an in-depth study of the Passion history, in particular comparing the various Gospels, the remarkable clarity that comes out from these four different perspectives and retelling of these familiar events. But one thing that came out to me, and maybe I'm wrong on this, but that the arrest of Jesus, done at night, was in some sense a covert operation. Now, maybe I'm wrong, but under the cover of darkness, Jesus is taken. Jesus even seems to say to his captors at one point, look, I've been out there in the open, in the temple, preaching in the temple, and you didn't attempt to grab me. What's going on this time? Are the rulers of the people, the chief priests and the elders, trying to take Jesus into custody in a covert, stealthy way? And if so, why? We're talking with Dr. Paul Meyer. He's professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo. We'll take a break, and we'll get the answer to that question when we come back from this break. He is author of several books, including In the Fullness of Time and our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for April, called The Very First Easter. When we come back, I'll also tell you how you can get The Very First Easter. It is a book for your children, and it is a book that can answer many of the questions we've been talking about regarding the events leading up to the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. We'll be right back.
A voice in the wilderness of American evangelicalism. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
What did Jesus say and do on the night he was arrested? In our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for April, The Very First Easter, Dr. Paul Meyer retells for your family and your children the story of Jesus' betrayal, arrest, crucifixion, and resurrection. You can order The Very First Easter online. Go to our website at issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on this book. Issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours at 1-800-325-3040. When you call or write, Be sure to ask for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April, the very first Easter. The cost is $12.99, 1-800-325-3040. Call weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040.
Now this Global Minute focuses prayer in a girl in India who fought and hated to study. Ramabai Mukti Mission is a Christian ministry in India to help women and children who find themselves in tough circumstances. Abita was just 7 years old when her grandmother brought her to Mukti Mission. She fought with other girls and adults in authority. She failed in 5th grade, 9th grade, and even in 10th grade in Mukti schools. During this time, her Christian house mother kept praying and praying for her, and Abita's life began to change when she accepted Christ as her Savior. Today, she enjoys helping the younger children on the Mukti campus and is studying hard to finish high school. Pray that Abita will thrive and impact other girls for Christ. Pray for Mukti children like Abita with a free copy of the Mukti magazine. Call 1-800-268-0461. That's 1-800-268-0461. Ask for the magazine on India.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. In 1564, King Charles IX of France introduced a new calendar. Before mandating this change, the new year was celebrated from March 21st until April 1st. But the new calendar set January 1st as New Year's Day. Some people didn't adjust to the change and kept on celebrating April 1st. They came to be known as April Fools. Pranks soon became part of the duty of this day. Hindsight is 20/20. If someone fools you today, you won't realize it until later. And that, I suggest, is a little ray of insight on reality. In his parable in Matthew 25, his parable about the five wise and the five foolish virgins, Jesus makes it clear that it's at the end of your life, Judgment Day, that spiritual wisdom or folly will be revealed. A recent Gallup poll showed that 2/3 of American adults believe in hell, but only 1% thinks they'll go there. If you are in the 99% that doesn't expect hell, make sure your reasons are right. 1 Corinthians 1:18 says the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing.
AM 850 KFUO salutes our day sponsor on this Tuesday, April 1st, 2003, Olene Saffel. Today's day sponsor has made a contribution to AM 850 KFUO in memory of her mother's birthday. Her mother was born in 1892. Once again, we say thank you to Olene Saffel of Perryville, Missouri, today's AM 850 KFUO day sponsor.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're talking with Dr. Paul Meyer for about another 5 minutes on the events leading up to Jesus' death and resurrection. In particular, we're here at the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus' betrayal and arrest. The question I asked before the break, Dr. Meyer, having to do with kind of what appears to me kind of the covert nature of this operation in order to do this while you said everyone is at home in bed for the most part. By the time they wake up the next morning, Jesus is on his way to the cross.
Certainly is, and I think you're right on the ball when you talk about a covert operation, and there's a reason for that. There's a reason for that. You know, we commonly think that during Holy Week, Jesus is losing in popularity every day. He's very popular on Sunday, people are yelling Hosanna and so forth, and then he cleans the temple on Monday and therefore starts to lose some of the support from the economic element, and Tuesday and Wednesday loses more and more, and finally there's nobody there left to support him, I should say, and everybody wants to crucify him on Friday. That's a traditional explanation, I think, is wrong. I think Jesus is actually gaining in popularity every day during the week. On Monday, he's very popular with all of the Passover pilgrims who don't like the jacked up prices at the temple markets with kickback to Annas, Caiaphas and company. So there are always more buyers than sellers, as you well know. So, and then Tuesday and Wednesday, the authorities are so panicked that they try to ensnare Jesus in his conversation, posing him these impossible questions, except Jesus answers perfectly. Therefore, that plot boomerangs back on them. Thursday, he can't lose any popularity because he doesn't go downtown, spends the last quiet afternoon, and so the authorities are quite happy to get Jesus at night away from the crowd, away from the crowds that might have been cheering on Palm Sunday, and the people, most of whom I think still supported Jesus, don't know about it till it's too late. And that's Friday morning. I mean, there's no, CBS, NBC telecast the night before, a prophet from Galilee arrested, film at 10 or something like that. There's no Jerusalem Dispatch newspaper announcing it all. And so they don't know about it till it's too late. The good people, you might say, those who would support Jesus. That's why the covert operation takes place at night.
So not to get ahead too far into the trials of our next week's conversation, but these people who are crying, crucify him, at the trials are not the same people who are saying Hosanna.
Are not the same people, Todd. I think it's very important. Way back when I was a kid, I was taught the other way, that people were fickle. They could cheer Jesus on Sunday and yell crucify on Friday, and as though they're the same people who changed their minds. I don't believe that's true at all. I think it's a different hunk of the population. We know who was involved on Good Friday cheering, I should say, jeering, and condemning Jesus, and that would be the sacerdotal Sadducee and aristocracy in Jerusalem, Annas, Caiaphas, and company. They can marshal however many people they want at the drop of a priestly admonition. I can just see on Friday morning, Caiaphas, sending out an email, so to speak. Hey, we're going to hit the bricks in front of Pilate's place today. You want your job? Be there. We'll tell you what to say. And for that reason, they don't have any trouble getting kind of a hired clack, a speech choir there to go yelling crucify. And we got to keep the various segments and parties of Jews separate.
Now, you have written our Issues, Etc. book for the month of April, beginning today, the very first Easter. It is a book, beautifully illustrated, by the way, as well, for children. Why a book for children that basically is on the historicity, death, and resurrection of Christ?
Todd, only because these first impressions are the most important, as you well know. That's about in everything. Whether you're being interviewed for your new job, first impressions are terribly important. But they're especially important in life, and especially important in the greatest story ever told. I wanted the children to get it right the first time. I know that my subsequent career of matching the evidence, sacred and secular, from the ancient world, was born back in Sunday school days. When I was so concerned and so interested in these biblical accounts, I wanted to always know more. Is there any way to prove this happened, this kind of thing, And for that reason, it just kind of shaped my whole life's career. So never underestimate the impression that Sunday school teachers and parochial school teachers make on their kids that they're teaching. And so I wanted the kids to get it right away.
And next week we'll be talking about the three trials, as they're usually enumerated, of Jesus. Give us a brief tease of what we'll hear next week.
Okay, we'll be talking about the religious trial or hearing before the Jewish Sanhedrin, then the Roman trial before Pontius Pilate, which of course is interrupted when they try a change of venue routine when Jesus goes to the court of Herod Antipas, Herod's son, for another trial. And then he goes back, as you well know, to Pilate's tribunal. We'll try to explain the motives behind those various judicial hearings.
Looking forward to it. Dr. Paul Meyer, thank you again for being our guest on Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Todd.
Dr. Paul Meyer is professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, Michigan. He's author of several books, including In the Fullness of Time and our Issues, Etc. book of the month for April, called The Very First Easter. Now, you can purchase both of these books at Concordia Publishing House's South Jefferson bookstore and the Concordia Seminary bookstore here on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. Or you can order our Issues, Etc. book of the month for April, called The Very First Easter, by calling Concordia Publishing House during regular business hours. You still have about 90 minutes to order this. And I would say this as well. If you're thinking about getting this book for your kid or your grandchildren, you better do it early so you can have it in time for Easter. It makes a great Easter gift, called The Very First Easter. Concordia Publishing House's toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040. The book costs $12.99, 1-800-325-3040, or you can order the book online at our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section, and there you'll find information on the very first Easter. Now, when you call or write, ask for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April, the very first Easter, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. For the remainder of this hour, we're joined by Dr. Pia D. Soleni. We're going to be talking to her about two issues, the first one being the impact of cloning on women, and we'll also get to the issue of this AIDS relief bill in the U.S. House. Dr. Pia D. Soleni is research fellow for the Center for Human Life and Bioethics for the Family Research Council based in Washington, D.C. Dr. D. Soleni, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks so much. It's great to be back with you.
We talk a lot about cloning as a general issue for life. What in particular with regard to women does cloning, what particular problem does it pose for women?
Well, with cloning, you have to understand that every instance of cloning requires a woman's egg. We cannot have cloning without eggs. And the question is, where are you going to get these eggs from? Well, you're going to get them from women. And what is the procedure involved? Well, it's a long procedure. It's somewhat painful. It is extremely risky. There's a young woman in Stanford last year that was offered about $50,000 for her eggs. And she suffered a stroke during the procedure. A lot of the medications that are used, if not all of them, have never been approved by the FDA for use in that procedure. The sheer numbers that we're talking about, we like to use the example of diabetes. If we just wanted to cure diabetes, you know, what are we talking about? Well, right now in the United States, there are 16 million diabetes patients. And getting the best successes, which we've had with animal cloning, which isn't very good, scientists would have to obtain a minimum of 800 million eggs, because each instance of cloning involves 50 to 100 eggs. Some scientists say even more, thousands of eggs. The head of ACT says thousands of eggs. But even if you're assuming a model of 50 to 100, you're talking about 800 million eggs, which would be required. And that means you need at least 80 million women to donate eggs, because in each donation process or harvesting process, a woman donates between 10 and 12 eggs. But in the United States, we only have about 64 million women who are of a fertile age and from whom these eggs could be extracted. So where are we going to get these eggs from? I mean, I think the natural answer is that it's going to come from poor, disadvantaged women, either poor, disadvantaged women in our own country or from other countries. You know, it's no mistake that right now in vitro fertilization companies, they target college students and they offer them a lot of money because they know that college students need money. And they know their market. They know where to go. And we're very concerned that the side effects for women, the women who would be targeted aren't in the right position to make a decision that is going to involve their lives so much and compromise their lives.
Now, this is the side of the whole stem cell research, human cloning issue that is very seldom talked about, the money side of this. I mean, I know that big biotech has an incentive to make money through the research, but we're really talking here about taking advantage through payments of money to women most vulnerable to undergo what is called the super ovulation process. Can you describe to us not only the general risks, but what a woman is being asked to do when she donates her eggs?
Usually typically, she undergoes psychiatric and medical evaluation. Now, Senator Brownback last week sponsored a session of hearings precisely on this issue up on the Hill. And one of the experts was a woman, I think her name is Dr. Castillo from Miami. She's very, very much in favor of this process, but she admitted that for every woman that passes the screening, both medical and psychological, there are about 9 that fail. So, you know, for every 10, you get 1. Then the next step are the drugs that they have to take, and that is usually a regimen of injections on a daily basis for 2 to 3 weeks. And that, you know, it's an intense period of ovulation, so the woman's body is undergoing a lot of hormonal changes. Some women become ill. Some women aren't able to work. And then the actual procedure itself is a surgical procedure to remove the eggs. So So that's just from a purely physical perspective.
And that's not without risk. We're not talking about something that, you know, like going in and having your teeth cleaned or something.
Right. No, we're talking about women suffering from risk of stroke, excessive bleeding, future fertility being compromised, some heart problems, blood pressure problems. These have all been noted by the drug makers and by the people who have undergone these procedures.
And in the worst case scenario, you talked about the woman who suffered a stroke during the procedure. How uncommon would that be?
Maybe it's fairly uncommon in terms of 1 or 2%, but when you're talking about millions of women, that 1 or 2% gets really big.
Now, is this already happening on a regular basis? It's noted in a press release I have in front of me that at this point, this kind of cloning research is currently legal in America and is underway.
It is, yes, that cloning research is underway. It is legal. Advanced Cell Technologies up in Massachusetts, they're the ones that in November of 2001 announced that they had cloned the first embryo, of which we never saw any proof, by the way. But they are publicly undergoing this type of experimentation and taking it forward, and they've solicited women, and they pay them about $3,000 for each egg donation process. So that's public knowledge. Then we also have women on the other side that donate their eggs for in vitro fertilization, to donate their eggs to a couple that's infertile. So it's a fairly common process.
Now,
and if you pick up any of your college papers or your city papers and you go and look through the classifieds there, you'll see some interesting ads.
Now, the woman who donates her eggs ostensibly to an infertile couple
mm-hmm.
for in vitro fertilization, does she have any guarantee that those eggs that are not used for the IVF procedure, say it's successful the first time or something like that, the eggs that will not be used, the so-called surplus embryos, would not be then used for other research purposes leading up to even cloning and stem cell research?
No. And, you know, this is one of our concerns as well, that the whole in vitro fertilization, the whole business is largely unregulated, and they do not have reporting standards. So we don't even know what we're talking about in terms of how many eggs are out there, what type of accountability do they have to patients, the follow-up that patients have experienced, whether or not they've experienced follow-up, whether or not their wishes have been fulfilled. We don't know, because that industry has been largely unregulated.
Do we need then some legislation, or at the very least some regulation, in order to get the standard of reporting up so we know what's going on? But beyond that as well, the Brownback bill would ban all forms of human cloning, and I assume would then make this a moot question.
A largely moot question. I mean, then it would only come up in the question of in vitro fertilization.
What kind of regulation would be needed? What precisely do we need?
Well, first of all, we need a procedure that's approved by the FDA, and we need drugs that are approved by the FDA, which means that we need some considerable studies. I mean, these drugs have never been approved by the FDA for use in this procedure. So that would be, before you can even talk about regulation, you've got to have the studies that take place.
Let's talk about the other issue before our time runs out here, Dr. DeSaleni. There's an AIDS relief bill that is in the House. I think it's H.R. 1298. Tell us about it.
That's correct. This is the legislative vehicle for the $15 billion package that the president announced at the State of the Union in January. Excuse me. We have a lot of concerns with it. There's been a lot of spin on it. It sounds great. Who doesn't want to help, you know, victims of HIV/AIDS throughout the world? I mean, there are a lot of innocent victims. Who doesn't want to help them? We're concerned because the bill doesn't give any priority to abstinence over condoms, and yet there is a growing body of anecdotal evidence that abstinence works. I mean, we have Uganda, in 10 years, their rate of HIV infection fell from 18 or 19% to 9%. That's substantial. And that was at the same time that they had, they started promoting abstinence over condoms. So that's one of the huge issues. And, you know, I've looked through the bill, and they always put abstinence on par with condoms, and you can't do that. I mean, no matter what your moral or religious beliefs are, abstinence is the only surefire way to avoid HIV infection through sexual contact.
So it's just, the only way. You're saying it's just common sense. If you're going to have a bill that would seek to reduce the incidence of HIV/AIDS globally, that abstinence, the proven deterrent, if you will, for lack of a better word, to this infection, be given priority.
Right. Yes. And you know, those who are promoting the bill, they say, well, we do talk about Uganda. Well, yeah, it's there in about two or three pages. But you know what? If you took those two or three pages out of there, you'd never know that Uganda was mentioned in there, because the Uganda model doesn't influence the rest of the bill.
What's your other concern?
We have several, actually. We're also concerned that money that's being set aside for treatment, rather than allocate that money to actual treatments, in other words, to some of the drugs that can be given to mothers and children when the child is born, there's an antiretroviral drug that can be given to the mother and the child that keeps the HIV virus from infecting the child. And that we know that it works. It's relatively inexpensive. And we need to put our money there for treatment. Unfortunately, the bill also allows money for a lot of research that would be speculative. One of the examples of this are microbicides, which basically work as, they're similar in, to a spermicide, but what they do is they protect, in theory, they're supposed to protect a woman from HIV infection. However, the studies that have been done on microbicides so far show that they make a woman more susceptible to infection because of the vaginal lesions that it creates in the woman. So we want the money going for actual real treatment, not hypothetical treatment. And there's enough money going into hypothetical treatment right now. We want real cures for these people. We're also concerned there's a lot of percentages that are put forth at the end of the bill talking about, you know, well, 55% to this and 20% to this, and it looks good. There's nothing, but it's in a section that's called a sense of Congress, which means it doesn't have, there's no binding power to it. There's no sticking power to it. And it's like, well, that would be nice. And, you know, isn't this, these are great numbers, but there's nothing that's going to make that happen in the bill itself. The bill also does not mention sex trafficking. And it is a well-substantiated fact that sex trafficking and the sex trade does it spread AIDS and HIV infection. And we're going to be pouring millions, even billions of dollars into these countries, but we're not holding the host governments accountable for the sex trade and sex trafficking that goes on in their own countries. And I'm sorry, but, you know, despite what other groups may say, there is no way that you can seriously say that you're protecting a woman. You know, you have this 12-year-old prostitute that is working off, you know, she's working almost as an indentured servant, okay? And their approach is teach her how to use a condom and how to talk to her customer about condoms, and then she's going to be protected. That is unrealistic. What we need to do is stop the trade and stop the practice, and these governments need to be held accountable to it. And, you know, if we think about everything that this White House has done, I mean, the president has come out very strong against sex trafficking. And so this bill needs to have some language that reflects the work of this administration on that. We're also concerned about the Global Fund. The Global Fund is basically a fund set up to give money to HIV/AIDS projects. However, that doesn't mean that they give money to groups that are necessarily in line with the values of our country and with values that we support. For example, money was given to the UN to address the situation in Haiti because there were no local groups supposedly that could take the money. And the UN gave that money to UNFPA. Well, those are the people that support forced abortions and forced sterilizations in China. And those are the people that the United States does not want to give money to. We've been explicit in that. And this bill, in a sense, is opening a back door for it. Another concern is that health care is not well defined in the bill. We don't want health care to include abortion. Reducing the number of children born with AIDS doesn't mean that you can abort them. It means that you use antiretroviral drugs and you try and keep their mothers from getting infected in the first place. There's also some recent studies that have come out in England indicating that part of the spread of AIDS is due to dirty needles in hospitals and unsanitary conditions. And these studies are being currently being considered up on the Hill, and I think a committee has been formed to give special attention to them. We need to see, you know, if that's a serious spread, cause of the spread of AIDS, what are we doing to make sure that they've got better hospitals and more sanitary hospitals there? I mean, there was a story that the BBC just carried about a nurse in Botswana that vaccinated 83 school children with the same needle. So these are, you know, there's a host of agreements in of problems with the language, and what we really want is a bill that's specifically going to direct the money to programs that work. And also, we don't want, there are a lot of faith-based groups involved in throughout the world, but particularly in Africa, in addressing these issues, and we want these groups to be able to address treatment issues and abstinence education issues without being held to the promotion of condoms. And there needs to be respect for these groups, and I think these groups are often some of the best groups, the best sources for stopping the spread of HIV/AIDS. Many of them have been in communities for a long time and working there. They understand the sense of the people, where they're coming from, what their needs are, and we need to be able to facilitate that.
With only 1 minute before we need to go, Dr. DeSalani, where does this bill stand, and can it be fixed before it becomes law?
It's going to mark up tomorrow, which means that it will go to the, it's going through the International Relations Committee in the House, and the basic sense is that that bill is going to be passed. That precise bill will not be changed substantially to meet our concerns. Our hope is that if that's the case, that the bill will be defeated. But that's where we really need our listeners, you know, to contact their representatives, especially their states, especially their senators and representatives. Contact them in their local offices instead of in Washington. That way they know, the people in that office know, that it's someone from that particular district that's calling them. It's not just a phone bank. And they need to call and write and say, you know, we want legislation that respects the agenda of this administration, and we're behind it. This administration has done some tremendous things to promote life and the family, and we don't want it stopped on the floor of the House or on the floor of the Senate.
Dr. Pia DeSalani, thank you very much for being our guest again on Issues Etc.
It was a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Dr. Pia DeSalani is Research Fellow for the Center for Human Life and Bioethics for the Family Research Council, based in Washington, D.C. You can visit them on the web at frc.org. That's frc.org. Or you can call them, area code 202-393-2100. It's area code 202-393-2100. When we come back from this break, we're going to be talking with Doug Wilson about classical Christian education. He's got a new book called The Case for Classical Christian Education. Stay with us.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.